And we're live with our 304th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. We're rolling in a little bit late today, just again, life getting in the way. And we're just both busy. It's Q4, right? And Ken is traveling for Q4 as well, so take it with a grain of salt. We are here, though, to talk. There's quite a lot going on in the industry, so there are definitely things to talk about. Obviously, the OWASP Top 10, we had Brian Glass, Professor Brian Glass, on our podcast last week. It was great to hear from him. But there are a couple of items that I wanted to bring up before we dive into a few articles and topics that are on our minds. First up, this week, we are teaching Harnessing LLMs for Application Security. This is Thursday and Friday. There are still a couple of seats available if you would like to attend. You can find information on training.absoluteappsec.com. On top of that, the class in London in December that covers both secure code review and harnessing LLMs for Black Hat is, there are still seats available there as well. That is a 4-day course. It is going to be intense and a lot of hands-on, and you're going to be building basically your own kind of SaaS process using AI. So I'm looking forward to both of those. There's some really good content. We've been doing updates to scripts and to slides and everything else to support both of those efforts. And we learn a lot as well as we try to teach exactly what we're doing. And yeah, it'll be good. So we've got both of those opportunities. You will be able to do the same thing at KernelCon next year. That's another one that's upcoming. I think we can announce, it's not on the website, I don't think yet, but Black Hat Asia will be teaching out there in Singapore. I know we've got to get some contracts and some other things signed and done on that. But yeah, just watch for those opportunities. Excited to just get out and see people and keep training and teaching people what we've learned over the last couple of years. Outside of that, Ken, any other place? Like, it sounds like you're at a conference right now. At a conference, adjacent to a conference in a hotel room at the moment, but anywhere else that you're actually attending or going in the near term?
Brian, there you go, Brian, that there is another person there for his comment in Slack. And so, sorry, I don't know if you saw that, Seth. In any case, I'm at AI Native DevCon. I've never been here before. There are workshops today, and then I have a booth I'll be working tomorrow. But one of our folks is already there at the conference, and it sounds like the workshops are kind of, I wish I was there, but unfortunately I have too much to do at the moment. You know how it goes, man. It's like this is, for me, it's not like a specific quarter. I know for you, Q4 is your heavier quarter. For me, it's more just like I guess it's good in a way. I guess I shouldn't be I shouldn't feel overwhelmed or anything or whatever, because it's like, well, we've got a decent number of customers now, and that's the real reason for the up and people going through trials and demos and things like that. We've got engineering work that has to happen. And last week I was out in Austin, Texas for a company summit. So the whole company was around. It was a lot of fun. We did 3 full days with a 4th day of like travel and stuff like that. And it was good. But anytime you're away from hands-on keyboard work for that long, stuff builds up. So then coming into this week, now I'm sitting in a hotel room basically yesterday and today, just when I'm supposed to be doing other stuff, making up for. So it's not, one thing. It's like multiple things. And like I said, it, in a way it's like, well, we've got some, whatever measurement of success you want to use here. So it's just a product of having people I actually have to service and do things for. So not too bad, but yeah, it is. I am like excited because tomorrow, Gene Kim, Phoenix Project and things like that. He's going to come to our booth, Dry Run Security's booth, and do a book signing tomorrow on the vibe coding book that he created. So I don't know if anybody's listening and happens to be at AI Native DevCon in New York City, in Brooklyn, tomorrow around, I think, 3 p.m. Eastern, we will have Gene Kim there doing a book signing. So that should be fun.
Nice.
But yeah, that's this week. Then I fly back tomorrow night, and then Thursday and Friday, you and I give our virtual course. And then I'm looking forward to as much as, like, are you going to be able to take time off during Thanksgiving weekend, next weekend, given that it's Q4? Or are you still going to be working through that?
There's probably a couple of small things that are ongoing, but we have scheduled stuff around Thanksgiving for the team. So unless something crazy pops up, which I don't see, like, we're definitely getting towards the middle and holiday season as far as Q4 goes, right? Like, people have put in their requests and now they're just trying to complete everything before they finish the year out. So it's been busy for us, but it hasn't necessarily been completely overwhelming this year. I think, you know, it just depends on who you're working with, what the partners look like, and what needs people have. That being said, it is only, you know, mid-November, so everything could change in, you know, 3 days over the course of this week, you know, depending on what demands we have and what actually comes in.
I was thinking about too, because you also have, like, longer term, anybody that has longer term clients with longer term contracts, those people could just, like, at a whim come in and say, oh, by the way, I need this thing. In the middle of, like, being completely busy with Q4, people could be like, oh, hey, I chose now to be like, you should do a scan of this mono repo, or not a scan, a code review of whatever this mono repo or whatever.
It's only going to be, you know, 200 hours worth of effort. It's fine. Yeah. You guys can do that totally, right? Like, you just jump on it. Yeah. So, crazy times, right? I don't know, like, as far as, like, items that we want to talk about today, there's been quite a bit of activity actually in Slack, like in multiple Slacks that we're both a part of. I think we're all still digesting the updates to the OWASP top 10. I don't know if you had any specific thoughts, right? I know you've been heads down doing other things, so probably haven't had as much time to analyze, but what are your thoughts, or what are your, I know we don't have Brian on here to defend the, you know, the official line from the project team, but yeah, go ahead.
No, I don't know if I have, like, huge opinions or anything, but I did, we kind of walked through at the company summit, you know, the OWASP top 10 and some of the, basically Brian coming on and giving giving information. And then also his viewpoint was extremely helpful for me to kind of, and some of the people from my company had already seen the podcast, so that was helpful for them. But, like, I think a couple things that stood out were CWE mapping. Like, for us, that's something that's very contentious. I don't want to say very contentious. Actually, that sounds worse than, that's not the right word. It's more of like an active debate about how we map things and create risk and calculate risk and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, each organization we deal with has their different feelings. I haven't seen anybody yet who's like, no, it has to be CVSS or it has to map to CWE or something like that. But knowing even just the fact that it went from 1/3 of CWE identifiers being represented to 2/3, helpful for sure. But also, I think one thing, as we were talking and we were thinking about that mapping, you know, Brian had mentioned that these results come from, like, IaaS, DAST, SAST, you know, automated tools a lot of times. I'm sure consultancies as well, but I believe he mentioned as much, but definitely automated tools are going to have, like, I would imagine the lion's share of data, just because, like, volume, right? You can run a scanner and you can run a scanner often and it can find a lot of things, and human beings are going to take longer and blah, 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 blah. So just by the nature of it being, of how they work, I would imagine automated tools represent far more than human being assessments. And that's when it started to dawn on me. And I think it kind of dawned on me even during that conversation, and maybe I brought it up during the podcast with Brian, but, like, definitely after, I kept thinking about, so you kind of have this this feedback loop, right? Where it's sort of like, okay, well, we need to map to these CWEs and we're only going to find this subset of things. And we can only find these subset of things. And I know it's like, this isn't like to talk about AI native solutions, but I know that when we talk about like from pre-AI world, there's always going to be a subset of things you can only look for because you can only look for patterns and blah, 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 blah. There's limitations there. There's no question there's limitations. So if we just acknowledge those limitations, we can then say, well, okay, so we are kind of actively contributing to a list of things that is a predefined set of things that we can ever only look for. Does that make sense? Like, meaning if I'm drawing some conclusions here, if automated tools run more frequently, produce more data for the OWASP top 10, and are limited to only finding certain categories of vulnerabilities, whether that's IaaS or DAST or SaaS or whatever, doesn't it tend to lead to a conclusion that there are other things that maybe are happening, but it's just tools aren't like as often, if not more often, but just like tools aren't picking up on these things. So it is something my team and I were talking heavily about and thinking about, and then also wondering how, you know, if we're not if we're not mapping to the CWE list, then how could we, because we want to contribute to the OWASP top 10 too, right? We want to be someone that mm-hmm. can provide data. That's important to us, especially because I think any like vendor who is doing it the new way really almost has an obligation to feed back into this. So that way those tools that were limited to a subset of exploit categories or vulnerability categories that they could review for, you know, we can add their data plus the new way of doing things data and see where it lands and maybe get a more robust list. So, but then how to actually do that if you're not mapping to CWEs is an open question. But so anyways, that's a long winded way of saying like, those are the things that were on my mind after that conversation. I'm not sure if you had anything that was either related to what I said or just generally speaking, yeah. You had your own things that you thought about later.
Yeah, I've actually started a blog post just kind of stepping through each of them as an old hat, right? Like as somebody that's been in the industry for, you know, more than 5 years, I guess, right? Somewhere around there. And one of the things that I keep coming back to, and I'll go through it and like, I'll post this, you know, this week, I'm hoping to get it up, you know, later this week. But one of the things that I keep running into and thinking about is how we've migrated from the OWASP top 10 being vulnerabilities to being risks and what the consequences of that actually are. It's great from a training perspective and an awareness perspective of, you know, these are the things that you need to think about. And it does speak to my training, talking about AAA, talking about CIA, and, you know, how the different vulnerabilities pop up within those triads and the risks that are associated with that. But part of me thinks that we lose a little bit of focus on upcoming research, new things that are actually being exploited, and things that are being found across the industry when we do go so broadly, right? You know, you look at each of those categories and we've got, you know, we could argue all day long about CWEs and whether or not one or the other actually applies, like where they're actually ranked. But each of those risks have at least, you know, 5 or 10 different CWEs in them. So like we're starting to lose that focus of these singular vulnerabilities are really the things that developers in 2025 care about or that attackers are using in 2025. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, but that's what my mind has been on when it comes to the OWASP top 10, especially as I look back to the initial iterations of those, of the list, right? Yeah, we got to be able to compare, right? And yeah, like part of me goes back to what Brian was saying as far as each organization needs to apply this to, or they need to create their own top 10 list, whether that's vulnerabilities, whether that's risks, whatever it is, they should have a list of things that they're trying to knock off. And they're going to know better than OWASP is, right? As an awareness document, this works, this we can train people about it. But it also is going to be interesting to see how the training vendors actually apply and teach authorization, authentication, injection, what it is they focus on. It's very easy to teach people about SQL injection and cross-site scripting because we've been doing that for years and we still see a high incidence rate of cross-site scripting specifically, but they're easy to actually implement and teach. But some of those other injection vulnerabilities don't get as much play. The reason that we had SSRF on there was because it was, you know, it was a problem and it can be argued that it's injection or it's broken access control, right? Like where we actually pull that up. And we got focus on it. We got a lot of play. We figured out some things, but I don't think the incidence rate ever rated it so highly that it would show up again in the OWASP top 10 without some sort of focus from the wider community. That's what I'm going to. I don't know if you've got.
Can I summarize? Because I want to summarize what I think you said, and then just like drill down. I think what you're saying is, okay, the OWASP top 10 is everybody's OWASP top 10. Your organization has, for several reasons, your own. There should be a desire and an effort to make your own internal OWASP top 10 at some regular frequency or interval. Now, I think what you're saying when we say for some of those reasons are, you mentioned training. That's one, and I think the other one, I don't know that you mentioned, you kind of mentioned around it, which is like burning down like a category of risk, right? A category of a vulnerability or a risk, however you want to define that. So like if IDOR is a real big problem, I want to burn down IDOR inside my my repos where that's occurring, or my source code where that's occurring, my apps where that's occurring. So, but going back to the training part of that specifically, like I don't think that there is a world in which SCORM compliant training makes sense anymore. And also, even with newer solutions that are more modern, like if you aren't using people's data, like to train them, what are we doing? I mean, you have all this information at your even if it's just, you know, I don't know, link to it or export some findings from your ASPM or your SIM or whatever, your bug ticketing system, aggregate it and say like, okay, what are some trends you see here? And then how would we fix this inside of my organization? It's like, I mean, you probably have a ton of, or at least some documentation inside of your org on how to properly do, like if we're using the IDOR example, how to properly build an authorization-backed RESTful endpoint or GraphQL mutation or whatever it is. You might have secure code docs already. Why not use that material to then build training content? My point being is that in the past, we didn't have some sort of intelligence that could easily synthesize and then create topics that were relevant for you. Now we do. So to me, it doesn't make sense that you have like all of this data about an organization, from the findings of the organization to its documents to whatever other systems you're able to link into. You have that information and then you wouldn't use that for like training. No, that doesn't make sense. So if I'm like a secure code warrior, for example, right? And I haven't looked at their product, so apologies if apologies if they're already doing this. I don't know. I'm using you as an example. So if I'm Secure Code Warrior, I'm building training content that's specific to your org, not general, like say, I don't know, Java vulnerabilities or something, you know, very, very, very generic sort of vulnerabilities, very generic recommendations and ways to secure that code. No, that's not necessary anymore. You can get very specific. So I hope that if they're not already, platforms like that are moving in that direction. Is that what you meant, by the way? Is that what you're saying, is that training itself could be more contextualized for yourself?
Yes. It's one thing to go to an industry conference and, you know, take a, you know, top 10 training or a security training. to start getting into the industry. And then it's wholly appropriate because it, at least it introduces the concepts. You'll touch a couple on a couple of the vulnerabilities associated with each of the top 10 risks, but it's not going to be comprehensive, right? Like I do feel like the OWASP top 10 is more comprehensive than it was in the past as far as the different attack types that are relevant and the risks that are associated with, you know, hosting a web application. But that's where I flip back and forth between risks and vulnerabilities. And that an organization and a, you know, specific training for your developers should cover your risks, not necessarily the OWASP top 10. And that's always been the case from a customized training perspective, like Secure Code Road Warrior or whatever it is going to target your framework, your language, the vulnerabilities that you've seen in your penetration tests. And yeah, and I mean, help your developers actually identify that and move further along. So I had
training get into developers. I can just add on to what you're saying, and then we can go from there. Which are there's two things that were successful or the most successful. One, when the finding was something that really happened, like when it came in from, especially bug bounty reports, like the high critical, cost a lot of money. Usually some of the people that are receiving the training were on the teams that did the incident response cleanup, you know, like did the investigation. So they're, you know, this is like very personal to them anyways. And then you throw it into a real scenario, it becomes interesting. So that's always been successful for me. So I just want to say like that kind of, to me, that adds to what you're saying, which is like, yeah, if I'm basing my internal training off my internal OWASP top 10 I built, then it's going to be based off of real things we're seeing. And then you have really quality examples that will actually make developers interested in to hear what you're saying, not just some generalized, hey, SQL injection occurs and we should all care about that and blah, blah, blah. Second to that, what I've also seen, I guess maybe I should say not be useful. And this is why I was saying like contextualizing the, at least the poly or the fix based off of your own organization is that what failed is whenever I tried to use a solution that would have recommendations where it would give kind of basic language or framework recommendations. And they're like, but that's not how, A, that's not how I would do it, or B, and or B, it's not actually the way you would do it in our specific code base, because maybe we're using a library or maybe we've overridden that function to make it more secure and we would recommend doing it a different way, or I don't know, any number of things that can go wrong. But like, if you, again, if you have in this modern era, there are just too many ways to prevent giving a generic recommendation for fixing and instead using actual fixes that your own developers either have used in the past or would recommend. I just want to add to that because I think that like you're honing in on something that's, if you create internally your own OWASP top 10, there are a lot of good things that could potentially fall out of that. And I don't know, do you have any ideas beyond training and beyond like burning down a category of vulnerability where you could find, you see that kind of list being helpful?
Yeah, outside of training, right? Like, it goes back to kind of this incident rate and like the discussion that's going on in Slack that Brian has moved over there is also very interesting. Like this thought of, hey, we need to build something, like it would be nice to have other top 10 lists that got just as much scrutiny, right? The, you know, a top 10 for program or architecture or specific vulnerabilities based on the outcome that you are trying to drive, right? Like, what is it that you're talking about? I mean, you have like OWASP SAM and that project and the maturity models that, you know, do affect software security, right? Like, if you don't have executive level support for security in your software, guess what? You are going to be immature, and there's going to be ways that you can actually rank that and track that don't have anything to do with the top 10 risks of a web application, but have to do more with the the organization itself and the program and how it's been put together and what sort of artifacts are generated and all that goes into building secure software.
So this is almost like a blend of the OWASP Top 10 and a risk registry in a way.
Yeah.
Because I think I misunderstood because I'm a little, I traveled, I'm always.
Yeah.
I think when you travel, even though I'm in the same time zone, there's always a little bit of fog. So I'm understanding now what you mean. You're saying this in a meta level I didn't catch, which is not just the OWASP Top 10 or something like that. You're talking about, because I like this list from Brian, which is top 10 risks to developing secure software is like lack of recognition that AppSec is a risk, lack of dedicated capital and human resources, missing your weak security culture. I could go down this list and continue, but that has actually, it says nothing to do with the category of vulnerability. This is just a risk. And so I obviously can't train on a lack of recognition that AppSec is a risk. You can burn that category of risk down, but you can't. Well, I guess you could train your way to convincing somebody that AppSec, I don't know.
Well, there's different approaches, right? Like you can get more meta, right? You can zoom out and talk about the program and you can help build application security programs and what the risks are associated with that you're trying to burn down as you build it. And then there's also the very specific like tactical that we were talking about that, hey, there's these 10 vulnerabilities that keep showing up on our report. Yes, they're in the OWASP Top 10 as part of whatever risk, but they're specific vulnerabilities that we need to take care of. And you, for a functioning application security program, you have to have each lens into your risks, right? Whether it is vulnerability risk, whether it's just like application security risk, like the OWASP Top 10 is right now that you're trying to take care of, whether it's program risks that you're running into and support, there's a number of different ways that we could track that. And there's a number of different discussions that we could have across the board, across an SDLC that are either very tactical or they're very objective, right? As far as what you want to achieve and what is it that you're looking at. So I don't know if the OWASP Top 10 is always the best place to start for any given program. I know it's the list that we've adopted that's in all of the compliance standards, but I mean, Brian's list is probably more realistic if you're trying to build a program at a startup than the OWASP Top 10 is.
Oh, and he said it's much more of a SAM Top 10 list.
Yeah.
To which I half jokingly replied, so you're gonna build a SAM OWASP SAM list? Is that what you're saying?
Brian needs another project for sure. So. Yeah,
doesn't have enough on his already.
Yeah, I mean, what I said in Slack, I don't expect there to be a solution to this. If it was easy, they already would have come up with something because I know Brian and the team is very methodical and they're trying to achieve the best result for what the OWASP Top 10 is. So I'm not expecting there to be a change. I just, as someone that's been in the industry and seen the change to the OWASP Top 10 over time, I think it's a dual-edged sword, right? As far as, hey, we get certain recognition, but the lack of granularity from a vulnerability perspective, means that we're pushing that sort of training and that sort of analysis off on AppSec engineers or practitioners in organizations. And some of those organizations or a lot of organizations that I deal with do not have that role in the organization. So it means they're going to miss that. And all they're going to tactically do is answer whatever comes up from Expo, which we want to talk about here shortly, the scanners, right? Like I see this very commonly that people go out and use like Burp or Invicti or one of the other, web scanners and build out a list of vulnerabilities. And then that's their SOC 2 compliance, right? Or their pen test reports, right? That's what becomes their organization's top 10 because that's what they go after. And you've already spoken to it a little bit, right? Like as far as these tools and these services go, they have very specific vulnerabilities that they do a good job at finding, and other things that they fail at miserably. So.
They do, yeah. I would add, well, actually, I can't really copy and paste this comment over because of the way I'm set up right now, my machines, I should say, plural. But Larry has a comment over here about thinking about the OWASP Top 10 as like a waypoint on your journey. And then some of the waypoints you stop and you do more or less, you know, than in other waypoints, meaning some of these OWASP Top 10 categories don't mean much to you. You fly right by them. Others, you invest significant amounts of time. And I really do like the idea. I just want to like dovetail this all. It's like, I really do love the idea of your own risk registry, essentially. And yeah, I think it's a really awesome way to sort of burn down risks. Yeah. And it's not just vulnerability categories. I mean, like I can give you a concrete example of that, which is for us, I've talked about it so much on this podcast. I've talked about it so much on the AppSec Council, like the security review process. It's something that sticks with me to this day is that like I know how hard doing a proper security review pipeline is. I'm not saying like doing a security review, like meaning doing a security related review of something. I'm talking about literally the pipeline workflow of like, I'm going to submit something we're building into the releases process. And then from the releases process, there's some process that security plugs into, legal plugs into, so marketing, so on and so forth, right? What I mean is, once it reaches security, there are many teams in a bigger organization that have to now weigh in and do things. And this is just an area that I would say is probably a risk for most people. I would say it's a big, because it's more often than not, that part of our workflow in AppSec and ProdSec is broken. Most places I see it's broken. And you see that when people get audited, right? When you get audited and it's like, oh, here, pull samples, make sure that those samples followed your, you know, like whatever it is that they want to look at, make sure you followed your processes and make sure you get audited on all of that. And I mean, I'm sure that there are some pros listening to this who are like, I'm not worried, but a lot of us are, and a lot of us should be. And so that to me is an example of a pretty uniform risk that most organizations have and would need to address. So I really love the idea of just saying out loud, here are the areas we know we're weak, here's why, and then prioritizing and spending time on that kind of work. I mean, if I was given that,
I mean, you definitely would, right? And part of the, you know, in response to that, like one of the things that I see people struggle with is this introspection of an organization, right? It's hard to admit when you have flaws, and it's hard to recognize where your blind spots are. Yes, you've got like executive management that obviously, like in most large organizations, don't have the technical know-how or the technical knowledge to actually break that down. So they're trusting their subordinates. And eventually you get down to a level where somebody's overworked or whatever it is, and there's gaps, but they don't want to call it out because it's more work for them, right? You're starting to talk about like organizational politics and organizational behaviors that are not easily fixed or even identified in a lot of cases, right? There has to be a culture of transparency that doesn't exist in a lot of these organizations.
Yeah. Then, transparency is another risk, or lack of transparency.
It is. Yeah. Yep.
It's not even just people's faults. It's just like, honestly, think about like at our previous consultancy, when we reached 35 people, how much was going on and how much communication was required. Think about that at 3,000 or 3,500 or 35,000 or whatever, right? It gets weird. So I don't think it's on purpose. I think it's just a lot of like, there's too much going on for most of us. Hey, so about this expo, can I just say, sorry, not to like pivot, but I was thinking about this.
We can pivot. Okay.
Well, no, the reason I'm thinking about Expo is like it dawned on me, because I was looking through our list and everything, and it dawned on me like a lot of people reach out to me about Expo. I don't ever pay it, and it's not like those people who founded Expo were from GitHub's SEML LGTM
team. Yep.
Yeah, they had already been acquired before by GitHub, and so. Yeah, this isn't like, I guess I'm saying that to say like, I don't mean this offensively. I just have not paid attention or really found it to be, everybody else is very interested in it. And I'm curious to know, I guess like we've already seen that AI has like can do some pretty incredible things. It's interesting to me that people, I think it's because if I had to guess, I would say because of the players involved and the money involved, it's like, that's why they're a big thing is what I would imagine. But I also think there's some ramifications of like, or for instance, when they used bug bounty platforms as sort of a marketing / proving out their product platform, that generated a lot of noise. Cause now it's like, oh wait, so this already kind of like muddied water landscape of bug bounties is going to be further muddied with some AI actors, and they're actually doing well in the sense that they're getting payouts and whatever. So that makes sense why there's like some feathers ruffled in that space and all that. But I haven't paid a ton of attention. Now, what I have heard, this is not to disparage, what I have heard, privately are some interesting things. I think there's some limitations I wouldn't have expected on how they can, especially when it comes to our world, like not, I can't speak to their red team networking, all of that kind of like meaning like attacking, network level assets and things of that nature. I can't speak to. But when it comes to web apps, however, I have definitely heard of some limitations that really surprised me given I'll just say it out loud. I mean, frankly, the amount of money they've been funded with, it's kind of, that was a little surprising. I can't speak again. I haven't used the product, so don't listen to me and be like, oh, Ken says this. I was like, I don't know. I've just heard feedback that on the web app side, like horizontal priv-esque testing is a little rough, if not non-existent. And there's a couple other things though, so I don't want to disparage them. That's just what I know. So, that's everything, Seth. So I'm asking you, what's kind of the big reason and the big draw for Expo to get a lot of attention? Also selfishly, I'd like to know that because I'm like, hey man, we've been around for a few years doing really, really cool stuff that nobody talks about. Like, how do I get that kind of microphone? Secondly, have you used it? Have you heard of people using it? Do you know the results? And third, any other flavor, I guess, to throw on here about them?
Yes. So I have not used Expo, right? Like, and honestly, from a boutique consultancy perspective that does a lot of like app pen testing, application assessments, definitely like industry-wise and my peers are nervous about what Expo is doing. That being said, this 6K compliance pen test that's out there, and I've seen some reports from what's actually being generated, has me kind of shrugging my shoulders. It's the same sort of analysis that we've done with LLMs in the dynamic space, as far as, right, like what is it good at identifying and how do you actually operationalize that? So kudos to them for actually doing that for like this. They've created basically a penetration test or a web app pen test that a platform that will compete with the Burp Suites and the Invictis of the world and probably will identify some results that those other tools will not, right? And that's where they're getting, I think, the valuation from is this ability to actually generate valid findings, validate them, and the false positives are lower because they're able to actually generate some of that. Now, when I look at the list of vulnerabilities that they are going after, And I'm sure it will grow, but as of right now, I question whether it really is a compliance test, right? Like whether it does cover the same amounts of things that an Invicti or a Burp Suite actually does, because it is a very limited subset currently. And I mean, if you were watching Slack the last few days with some of the analysis that Andrew did, right, based on the valuation that they got, they have to, you know, to actually turn a profit, right, actually be in the red and justify the valuation, they need to be doing somewhere in the order of 50 to 60 pen tests.
Yeah, I see 55 pen tests a day. Yeah, I didn't see this. I actually hadn't been paying attention, and I apologize. I've been traveling a bunch. But yeah, this is interesting.
Yeah.
I did not see the math you worked out on this.
Not that, you know, like valuation math ever really like comes into it when we start talking about investments and investors, right? Like, you know.
Oh my gosh, you're not wrong, man. It is.
Yeah.
I love it because they do pretend that there's so much math involved and there's like all kinds of the like this analysis and whatever. But like the reality is they're so driven by vibes, it's not even funny. It's so true. Yeah. Like you can see they're like, well, this person just did this and it sounds cool. And like I get emails where it's like, is this like should we be concerned about this? Or, you know, it's just kind of funny. Like it's very vibe oriented and like it comes from their network. Right. So they're people that they're connected to. They'll ask anyways. You hit on a point that makes me laugh so hard. It's just this like fake, like, oh yeah, we're doing this tons of like Wall Street level analysis. And it's like, all right, let's be honest. You called up so-and-so and they said, yeah, that seems good. And you're like, all right, that seems good. Like, you know, anyways, all right.
It's the one guy on your team that does, yeah, that you pay $500 an hour to do, you know, market research and analysis of a specific sector when it's only quasi adjacent to what they've done for the last 20 years. Right? No, I like, yeah, I, yeah, we have no idea about any of that. But
I've literally had, and I have to be careful about this, but what I can say, how can I phrase this in a way that I can't like get myself into? Because I do want to say this, it's kind of funny. Like I've definitely had moments where, let's just say that somebody wasn't interested, right? And then they've come back like literally two months later and are like, okay, so I've pivoted and instead we want to do this with you. And you're like, what? I thought 2 months ago you didn't believe, literally 2 months ago, you didn't believe in any of this. And it's like, well, since then we've collected enough market, this, that, and it's like, no, you didn't. Like someone just like in your network told you that these companies have been selling contracts and you're like, okay, well, this is, then yeah, like I should probably invest in it. Anyway, all right. That's as far as I'll go with all that, but it is really funny to me. It is very vibe driven as much as it's pretended that it's not. So back to Expo.
Well, and I mean, so there was the post that came out from their CEO that was like, hey, this is, you know, this is what's great. And then I don't know, like, yeah, you saw kind of the normal players, you know, pipe in and start asking questions about what exactly it was that they had achieved, where they had actually driven things, if they were looking into source at all, right? Like that was one of the comments on the post. You had some responses from, you got to love Sean over at Atreides, right? Like, you know, about how what they're accomplishing is, I mean, they're adding a tool to our quiver that can be used, but it's not going to replace the, you know, in-depth analysis that's currently going on. If anything, it'll make it easier for manual testers to spend time on things that matter as opposed to this kind of low-hanging fruit. And that's part of what's happening in this transition in this space is what used to be novel and require a manual pen tester to find has now become rote and low-hanging fruit. SQL injection, cross-site scripting. Guess what? Automated tools are better at finding that. They are. And with the analysis that LLMs provide, we actually can get to the point of a confidence level that means I don't have to spend time as a tester actually going in and trying to exploit that. I can basically say, hey, you know what? If Expo came back or whatever tool that you're using and told me there was SQL injection, most likely there is. Whereas in other older scanners, that wasn't always the case. Same with cross-site scripting, same with some of these other tools, but with the myriad of tools that the LLMs and agents have available to them nowadays, they can go in and confirm that, and that's going to be the play that happens. Now, that doesn't mean that the LLM is going to be able to find the business logic flaws. We're still seeing them struggle with a lot of the authorization stuff that's out there without very, very specific customized prompts for an application. It doesn't know what is authorized and what is unauthorized, right? Like it still is a really hard problem to solve. It's easier to see in the code for sure, right? But from a dynamic perspective, I still think it's going to struggle without access into the code. So I think that's what I'm kind of getting towards is it's impressive. And yes, it will satisfy compliance needs. But we already had scanners out there that satisfied compliance needs. So is it worth it to pay $6,000 to Expo, or can you just go scan with Invicti for $2,000? If that's all you're looking for, that part of the market was already kind of gone from a manual perspective and actual like identification perspective.
That's interesting because you're saying that like it doesn't just because this is that is actually to me anyways interesting, which is because I was thinking, well, okay, so you know, if somebody's going to Expo and they're like, well, I can pay $6,000 and I can get my compliance box checked, is that even a client you would want? But then it's like I'm asking a question that you've already answered and dealt with before. And I guess the only reason I thought about it differently from my end was that I was like, well, yeah, it is different because the results are better and you're going to find, well, anyway, presumably the results are better and validated and just overall you're going to deal with less crap and it's going to be a report that looks more like a person did it and whatever. But then as I was thinking about it and hearing what you had to say, I'm thinking, well, yeah, like I think the way you're thinking about it is true. People don't care. They don't really know. They just know like, well, this one's the newer one and it costs, like I said, $6,000 or whatever to pass compliance. And it's not really any different, even though it's a better, basically what I'm saying is I would think in my head, you know, all of that betterness would matter. And it doesn't, not if that is the reason that you've come there in the first place is purely for compliance, yeah. And nothing else.
I mean, who it's going to help is the developers that want real results out of those scans, right? Or the security team that does that is being forced to look for the value product, right? Like the one that's cheapest. If they can use Expo over one of those others and get better results that are better validated, then yeah, that's great from a security team perspective.
Something that I'm trying to understand is in my SOC, like I only have SOC 2. In SOC 2, yeah. It actually does have an annual third party pen test. Does purchasing a scanner meet that requirement?
It depends on your auditor, right? It depends on your auditor. Now, I mean, the thing about SOC 2 specifically is, right, like you know how SOC 2 Type 2 is you lay out SOC 2 Type 1 is these are our security controls as an organization, and then the Type 2 is actually the measurement of those controls. So if I put into my controls that we do a yearly penetration test, automated penetration test, guess what? As long as that vendor claims to be an automated penetration test tool, that will pass the compliance regulations that are associated with that.
Yeah, that's, well, I mean, I yeah, it does, definitely does depend. My auditors are not so easy, but I could see, I have obviously been through this more than once. There are, yeah, you're right. Your auditor actually makes a pretty big difference in what's acceptable and what's not. But it didn't even really, like when I saw third party external audit, you know, I would have never even thought of a scanner. I would have thought of a third party audit.
Yeah.
Seth.
Of an actual, you know, yeah. Granted that you've also been in the space, and that's the results that you expect and that you want, right? Like I know being internal, right? Like getting back a high value report is something that is extremely useful in fleshing out what your organization's top 10 is, you know, to put a bow on it, or to actually like enforcing or forcing change into your organization that you want to actually make things better. You're not going to get that out of some of those automated tools. You might, but most of the time it's a lot of just the low hanging fruit. Yeah, I know we are almost at about time. I did want to post this tool though. This is the open source version of Expo that KeyGraph, it's called Shannon, keygraph.io has released. All the prompts are in there for actually identifying cross-site scripting and the other things that they're actually scanning for. Very interesting to see somebody else actually come up with a similar system that is assessing web applications open source wise and claiming to be just as effective. So anyway, take that with a grain of salt, but go play with it if you would like. I have not played with it yet, to be frank. It's probably something that's going to happen over the next couple of weeks for us to see, you know, what's actually going into that scan as opposed to other things. But it's like any other tool that we're going to add to our quiver, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's all versus buy consideration and all that fun stuff. I do think with AI open source that you do have to be careful of claiming as effective as the commercial solutions until enough people have used it and enough data has been collected, because that is the murky world. I don't know. This could get out of hand, so I won't go into why and all the details, but I'll just say you do have. Data makes all the difference for understanding whether or not you're doing a good job. It really does. And I mean, volume of data and diversity of data too is really, really important. But anyways, I only say that because, like, you know, I get it. I've seen other people put out like open source stuff and just have to be careful. But I think that, I think it's awesome to see this space heat up. I just think people have to be kind of, you know, well, they don't have to do anything, but it is nice if we educate our customers and users, educate the community.
Yeah. Yep.
Trying to think of what else is relevant to talk about with them. I mean, do you think it's going to, like, actually, this is one question I have for you, which is, how do you see like consulting changing? Like obviously it has to, right? We've got these tool sets now that take what used to take hours and hours and hours, you know, it does it in minutes. And meaning like, and it's not just, I'm not just talking about just vulnerability scanning. I'm talking about whatever part of the assessment you're doing, there's always a tool to help optimize it and make it go much quicker. So for instance, during our manual secure code review course, we used to show people, well, we still do. We show people, you still need it. Show the people the process of like doing that context collection and all the different data points about the application you need to learn about and how to write, you know, document it all out. And then we gave out a prompt that does something that took us manually several hours before, or even sometimes a day, in 5 minutes, right? So obviously that's one example out of many of how your workflow is changing as a consultant. My question becomes, you know, does this mean, like, what are the ramifications of that? Does that mean consultants can do more with less and rates will change or scoping will change? Or do you foresee more consultancies popping up, or do you see the opposite? Do you see them being kind of condensed down? Or yeah, I'm just curious. There's a million ways this could go, but I'm curious if there's any like one or two things that you see being impacted, what are they?
I mean, currently it's been just a an improvement of our overall process and flow for doing a test, right? whether that's a code review or a dynamic or the combined, the ability to quickly identify places and authorization and, you know, patterns that that are going on in the application means it's easier for us to identify possible weak points quicker, which means I can be more confident. And guess what? What used to take me 3 weeks and that I would bid out as 3 weeks might only bid out as two. Like there will be some process in there, or hey, we're going to maintain that at three, and now we're going to actually go deeper into other categories of vulnerabilities and find other things that will make it even more comprehensive. So there's kind of that, you know, that dual path that we could take as far as what it is that we're actually looking at and looking for. As far as like organization, right? Like you're asking the questions that we're having internally as far as, okay, what does this actually do to our lines of business?
Yeah.
Because, well,
you know, it's like changing. Reporting gets better, right? Scoping gets better. If you have a client who's, you know, a regular biannual, I guess, or even quarterly level of assessments, right? Like it's much easier for you to take and summarize what's happened over the last 3 months. And then what are the most interesting pieces that are new that you should then focus on rather than going back and looking at everything else in an application. I feel like it would make first level triage where you're, you know, if you're like a, let's say you're service and MS, what is it? MSSP, is that the right? Like a service provider, where you're kind of that long-term extension, your contractor, you're an extension of their team. You know, it's like you can use AI for first level triage, and then both backed with their guidance plus your guidance, but then also, you know, you have, like I said, first level triage with an escalation path to maybe speak to you all. I feel like there's so much that, I mean, everything from like you performing addition, like I said, even doing training and being hooked into their systems and saying, oh, based off of all the data we've collected, here's where we should like do manual, in-person, live training on these topics or whatever it is. I mean, I just feel like there's so many areas, threat modeling, whatever, all the services that you and any other application security consultancy can provide would be optimized, you know, through AI.
Yeah, I mean, part of what I think we're seeing in the AppSec space specifically is that it's becoming more commoditized, right? Like you think back to the early days of network penetration testing, and everyone would just use Nmap, and then they had to kind of come up with their own exploits for the things that they found, and you'd have to go install software, and it was a revelation as things like Qualys and Metasploit and, you know, take your pick, right? Ncircle, like the old scanners that popped up, and then different exploitation frameworks and different ways to go after Windows networks or Linux boxes and being able to pivot and all this. All this actually happened, and they created automated tools for a lot of it. That's the transition that we're seeing in the AppSec space right now as well. There's still this, like the low level, like very technical expert level consulting and analysis is probably never going to go away. But we're making it easier for others to actually come into the space and run these tools and tell them what the impact is of having insecurities in those custom web applications.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah,
makes sense. I mean, you're just, Andrew, kind of
again, echo the same I'm kind of it's something we've seen in other spaces before, right? So it's hard for me to get super concerned about it because I've seen that transition happen and we've been through it in the past. Yes, it might happen a little quicker because of the way that LLMs work. But yeah.
Well, I don't really mean concerned so much as just, I mean more as like, how if I'm in your shoes, how do I use this to catapult my business and become more competitive against my competition?
Yeah,
So for me, that's I mean, obviously these days, especially, that's where my head's always at. How do I do better than my competition? How do I well, go a little faster, a little farther, a little better
than my competition? Well, and I know I've shared some of this, right? Like in the dynamic space, some of the tools that are available to us that were in the past just traditional QA testing tools, now them being exposed to LLMs gives us this superpower to do things, you know, basically create a crawler without having to create a crawler. You know, I was just utilizing this today. It's probably one of the things I'm going to add to the course is how do you actually crawl a site and get like all the data about it without actually having to crawl the site, but just having agents go out and do it for you and then gathering that HTTP session, and starting to identify vulnerabilities, right? And that's similar to things that Expo is doing or whatever else. But there's easy ways to do that as an application security person that weren't available to me even 6 months ago.
Oh yeah, no, definitely.
Now operationalizing it is a different problem, right? Like actually being able to utilize that and operationalizing it and making it automated so it's consistently, and you know this better than anyone, like consistent results out of an LLM and out of an AI is not an easy thing to achieve. So, yeah.
Hey, I'm going to add on to something Andrew just said here. So he said $6,000 for a compliant review is appealing. So is $400 an hour for someone to review your custom AI thingy majigger because you are worried about creating problems. I see both things happening, with the distinction being human support insight to translate differences. So a lot to unpack there. I will just say flat out, I agree. Like, for instance, I have an AI thingy majigger, as you call it, that is pretty complex. And I really got to experience that when I started trying to deploy the OAuth DCR OIDC bits that make it all work. So if you're not familiar, if you create like an MCP server and you want to do OAuth, which is really desirable because using a key, a PAT or something like that, all the considerations of a PAT plus if it's long-term storage, right? And you have other agent tools that are able to call your other agent tools that are using a PAT, then for however long you're technically exploitable, blah, 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 right? In the sense that like access gets maintained. So the more desirable options, OAuth with dynamic client registration. To do that though, especially if you look at the solutions out there, there's not a lot of solutions that support it. So you have to do some special things, and we did some special things. And that is a situation in which I would call you. I would not call I wouldn't even use a scanner for that. It doesn't matter how good of a scanner it is. Meaning like I would use it for, to the point of what we talked about, for some of the more like broadly fall into a category. I don't want to say low hanging fruit because like I know our scanner does more than low hanging fruit, but still I want a human being just at the end of the day to go through there. And I trust Seth's experience, right? So I'm still going to pay for Seth's level of experience. I'm not going to then outsource to some product only. So that is, to Andrew's point, a very bespoke comp. The reason is that it is very bespoke. It is very complicated. It's multiple different code bases. It's also like the configurations of a cloud environment involved too, right? Some of that's in IAC. Some of that is not always in IAC. Some of it's not even something you would do in IAC inside of like an AWS or another cloud provider. So when you're dealing with like multiple code bases, configurations that don't live inside of stored code, some that do live inside of stored code, and all the connections in between, and you're doing something novel, it's like, yeah, of course, a human being is still going to be my go-to. I just want that human being to like optimize their time so that they're doing the most with the time that I'm paying for. I'm willing to pay $400 an hour. I just want to know that my consultancy isn't over there spending, you know, I don't know, 45 minutes out of that 60 minutes of that $400 is just paid for doing something silly that, you know, doesn't make any sense in today's modern era.
Yep. So. Well, and I mean, I think that's never going to change, right? Like, and it's why, right, to the point, the discussion that we had earlier, it's why we've never chased as like a bespoke AppSec consultancy. We've never chased that low end of the compliance scanning market, right? Like there's tools that are out there. The value that we provide is the experience that we have with those code bases, with building that context. And we can use the AI to actually do that quicker, but there still is that like human element that needs to be there. One of the things that I am struggling with is how to get junior or just like mid-level consultants the experience that makes them expert level. Because a lot of that for you and I is the hard-earned, man, I had to bang my head against this wall to actually exploit this SQL injection 15 to 20 years ago. And what did I learn when I beat my head against that wall? And that's the experience that I'm utilizing nowadays when somebody comes in and says, hey, I found SQL injection. And I'm like, meh, right? Like, you know, nope, this is this, this, and this. These are the considerations that go into it. That context is required for a human to make that analysis and become an expert.
Right.
Guess what? You don't become an expert at like exploitation by going through CTFs. Right.
You don't become an expert from that, but you do. This is the weird part, though. You do get it from on the job training. That's really the only way. Like, let's be honest. That's really the only way. You could sit there. Are you still with me, by the way? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I am. Yeah.
Sometimes with this internet, I don't know if you're frozen.
Yeah,
because I'm like, well, look, you're still. I get worried. So just, I don't know, move around a lot.
I was keep saying.
I forget what I was even saying. What was I saying? I don't know.
We were talking about training the next generation, right?
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, it just happens on the job. That's like you can try and do whatever you want with training and all that stuff, but come on, like. It's like we talk about in our courses, like we always give people the frameworks for how to do things. We always, you know, fill that in and they can immediately go and start doing whatever it is that we're teaching. But the reality is that how good you get at that is based off of how many times you do it and follow whatever process or whatever we've set forth, right? It's just repetition, different scenarios and repetition. So unfortunately, like as much as I'd like to say that with junior people, the answer is, better training or whatever. It's like the reality is just doing the job. So that's where you get.
Well, and I mean, one of the advantages that I'm seeing here though, is they're better equipped to actually interact with LLMs to do these things than some of the old hats that are out there because
I've heard that about
going in. Yeah, because they're utilizing it, right? Like on a daily basis, they're going to Gemini, they're going to OpenAI, they know how to query it to get it to do different things. And so that extends to, hey, I need this agent to go in and look at things and wow, that result was not what I expected. So I'm gonna reframe things. I'm gonna use this, you know, prompt framework or whatever it is to actually like go about and enumerate, do the task that I want it to do. And so they do have certain advantages, right? Like being an iPad kid or whatever it is, they know how to navigate that technology better than, you know, than maybe I do, or maybe, you know, someone else that, you know, hasn't been utilizing that on a daily basis. Yeah. Anyway, there's no solution there, but yeah, we are losing some of those pathways. And so again, that's kind of what I'm struggling with is how do we get those juniors up to the point that they will be the experts in 10 years or 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, maybe part of it too is, well, I don't know. We could keep going forever. I have thoughts, but yeah. So do you. And then we're already at like an hour and 10 minutes. I probably I won't have time to get to the conference before my next meeting. Well, I'll get to that conference maybe before the end of the day today so I can get a patch. I don't know, we'll see. Anyways. So anything else you wanted to info dump on folks? I guess you already talked about we have you're welcome to try and sign up if you wanted to for, I guess, Thursday and Friday's virtual online course. And we're doing Black Hat in person in London next month. I don't even know if there's seats available. I know we had to like open it for more seats because we had hit our limit. So, but you can check that out if you want. And then I'm trying to think of what else, like we have, I think we've got, we're working on getting Avi from OWASP on the podcast. I don't remember if if we reached out to any other guests, but there's one other thing I did want to mention. Actually, is there anything you wanted to mention while I look this up?
No, just there are seats. Black Hat did open up more seats for us for that course. So you do have the opportunity to sign up there. If you have been waiting on that, we'd love to have you. Yeah. I think that's
okay.
That's probably about it right now. What was the last thing before we close things out?
It is called Coffee Chaos and ProdSec. It's a new podcast in our space. We're always trying to promote other AppSec and ProdSec podcasts. So it's by Cameron Walters and Kurt H. But anyways, they delve into like some pretty interesting topics. So anyways, just another podcast that came online. Coffee, Chaos, cool. And ProdSec.
Cool. All right. Well, appreciate the discussion and the interactions today. Always great catching up. Again, we will see everyone online and continue the conversation in Slack. You can find a link to Slack at absoluteappsec.com. And otherwise we'll catch everybody next week. Thanks all.
Thank you, everybody.